Good morning, Crossroads. Yeah, there we go. Okay, you're like, my name's Brent. I have the privilege of serving our house churches here at Crossroads. If you are unfamiliar with house churches are, they are our practicing communities where families, adults gather together, where we work out what it means to follow Jesus in the specific context and street corners he's called us to. It has been an absolute joy to work with the different leaders that God has raised up in and amongst our community, and I'm humbled by the privilege of seeing what incredibly godly men and women who are serving in this community and helping us wrestle with what it means to live out God's call in our lives. If you're new here to Crossroads, welcome. If you're visiting family, we also want to extend a welcome to you. We're thrilled that you are joining us here together this morning. We'd love to get to meet you. We have a connection center on the other side of that wall there. So after the service, come by and say hello and introduce yourselves. We just want to, in this big space, make you feel welcome. In preparation for this message today, I came across a quote by the French philosopher and satirist Voltaire, who says this: "If God has made us in his image, we have returned him the favor." In essence, if God has made us like him, guess what? We turn the tables and decide to make him in our image. And I think this quote bears out consideration in the passage we're going to study today. As we take a break from Acts, if you've been with us here through the course of the fall, we looked at the first 14 chapters of the book of Acts, where God pours his spirit out upon his people, and thousands upon thousands of Jerusalem come to faith in Jesus. Then with the martyrdom of Stephen, that witness spreads to Samaria, Judea, and beyond. And Paul and Barnabas then take the message beyond even the scope of that area into the world around them. And what happens at this point is the Jews who have come to faith in Jesus and the Gentiles who have come into faith in Jesus are at odds about what it actually means to live out this faith. And the Jews want them to follow specific rules, and the Gentiles, unfamiliar with those rules, are clashing. And the church is on the edge of a knife. The tension is coming to a boil. And there's going to be a council convened in Jerusalem in Acts 15, where Peter and the other apostles are going to wrestle with this question of what do we do? Where do we go from here? How do we take the faith that we've known and incorporate and really begin to be transformed by the reality of who Jesus is and what he'd called us to? And I believe as Peter and those disciples, apostles gathered together, reflected on what they were to do in this moment, they looked back on the scene we're going to talk about today in Mark 8. Because I think what happens in Mark 8 is Jesus provides a threshold for the disciples to walk over into an understanding of who he is. Because even though they had the living Jesus in their very material presence, they still didn't understand who he was or what he had come to do. And Jesus had to set them straight, lovingly but firmly, help them see who he really was and what he had come to do. So, in the first chapter, in the first part of Mark 8, we find Jesus with his disciples. He's been teaching the people for about 3 days, and he tells his disciples, "Guys, I feel compassion for them because they're hungry, and if we send them away, they're going to faint on their journey home. What should we do?" And instead of providing helpful solutions, the disciples go, "Yeah, that's really rough, Jesus. It's worse than you think." And so Jesus says, "Guys, let's get going. Let's problem solve here. How many loaves, how many fish?" 7 loaves and a few fish are offered to Jesus. He multiplies, feeds the crowds. They get in a boat and find some Pharisees who say, "Hey, Jesus, we want a sign." He says, "Wasn't that enough? But no other sign is going to be given to you because you're not looking in the right places." The disciples get back in a boat with Jesus, and this time they realize, as they look at their provisions, that they're down to 1 loaf of bread, and they start to argue. They start to get scared about how they're going to be provided for physically, and Jesus says, in this wonderfully teachable moment, "Guys, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and of Herod." In essence, be careful about the influence of the teaching of the religious and political order and how it's going to influence you. It's going to spread like leaven through bread. But all the disciples can hear is the rumbling of their stomachs and miss this point. And so Jesus, maybe in a point of exasperation, quotes from Isaiah 6, which Jeremiah so helpfully led out with us. When Isaiah says, "Here am I, send me," and God says, "I'm gonna send you," and this is what you're supposed to say. Keep on hearing, but don't perceive. Keep on seeing, but keep on looking, but don't see. Your hearts are hard. Jesus quotes this very passage to his own disciples. He reviews the history of what he's done as miracles, and he ends with this mic drop moment, this question that really sort of permeates the entire passage. Do you not yet understand? Have you been with me so long that you do not yet understand? And that question is going to filter through the rest of this passage as we look at it through the course of today. So if you would, we're gonna stand. We're gonna read Mark chapter 8, verses 22 through 38. And since we're in this Christmas season, I have all of my kiddos home and under one roof. I get to have one of my sons come and read for us. So Micah, come on up. If you'll open up your Bibles to Mark 8, 22 through 38, we will go ahead and hear what God has to say to us this morning.
Mark 8, verses 22 through 38. They came to Bethsaida, and some people brought a blind man and begged Jesus to touch him. He took the blind man by the hand and led him outside the village. When he had spit on the man's eyes and put his hands on him, Jesus asked, "Do you see anything?" He looked up and said, "I see people. They look like trees walking around." Once more, Jesus put his hands on the man's eyes. Then his eyes were opened and his sight was restored, and he saw everything clearly. Jesus sent him home saying, "Don't even go into the village." Jesus and his disciples went on the villages around Caesarea Philippi. On the way, he asked them, "Who do the people say that I am?" They replied, "Some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and still others, one of the prophets." "But what about you?" he asked. "Who do you say that I am?" Peter answered, "You are the Messiah." Jesus warned them not to tell anyone about him. Then he began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders, the chief priests, and the teachers of the law, and that he must be killed and after 3 days rise again. He spoke plainly about this, and Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. But when Jesus turned and looked at his disciples, he rebuked Peter. "Get behind me, Satan," he said. "You do not have in mind the concerns of God, but merely human concerns." Then he called the crowd to him along with his disciples and said, "Whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. For whoever wants to save their life will lose it, but whoever loses their life for me and for the gospel will save it. What good is it for a man to gain the whole world yet forfeit their soul? Or what can anyone give in exchange for their soul? If anyone is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, the Son of Man will be ashamed of them when he comes in his Father's glory with the holy angels." This is the word of God.
Thanks be to God. Thank you, Micah. What we find here in the last half of Mark 8 are three vignettes, three stories that I think are telling the same truth that Jesus wants us to get. And basically, he wants us to understand that our sight is not fully adjusted, that he needs to touch our eyes that we might see him more clearly, more fully, and be released as his people to live out his life in the world around us. The first vignette or story, it comes with Jesus and his disciples ending up in Bethsaida. It actually was the home of Peter and Andrew and Philip. It's also known in one of Jesus' denunciations of the different cities. You can see Bethsaida there at the north of the Sea of Galilee. He denounces their unbelief. He says, "Woe to you, Bethsaida and Chorazin, for if the miracles that occurred in you had been in Tyre and Sidon, they would have repented in sackcloth and ashes." In essence, Bethsaida, this hometown of some of his very own disciples, was known for its unbelief. And so Jesus and his disciples go to the space, and the people bring to Jesus a blind man, hoping even in their unbelief that something can be done for him. Jesus takes this man by the hand and literally leads him out of the village, because for this miracle to occur, he has to leave his unbelief behind. He has to be willing to set that aside and be brought into a new space. Jesus then spits in his eyes. Rather insulting, I would think. But I guess if you're going to have your eyes healed, you're willing to endure it. And then he touches him and he asks him, "What do you see?" And the man says, "I see men like trees walking around." Some would say this is Tolkien's inspiration for his Ents. his tree herders in Lord of the Rings who are literally trees walking around. But whatever it is, Jesus makes no comments. If he's glimpsing the spiritual world or whatever is happening, he simply touches the man's eyes again and says, "Now what do you see?" And his sight is restored and he sees clearly, implying that what he had seen before was not fully accurate. And then Jesus tells this man to go home, but don't go back to the village. Now that you've been healed, now that you've crossed this threshold of understanding, of healing, of belief, don't go back to your old ways. Don't go back to the village of unbelief, he says. So Jesus and his disciples continue on. And in many ways, it's fascinating you think about this first series because it's the only story in all of the Gospels where Jesus takes two times to get it right. It's almost like Jesus thinking, how does this thing work exactly? I don't think that's what's happening. But what's happening in many ways is this reality of this two-step process that many of us go through as Jesus brings this man through and the disciples are about to go through themselves. As they begin on their journey to Caesarea Philippi, this was known for being a pagan hotspot. It was known to have what's called the gates of hell, where the pagan worshipers believed that the gods would actually cross the river Styx to come and dwell amongst the humanity there. And so they were responsible for committing incredibly perverse sexual acts to lure their gods out of Hades to come and dwell amongst them and to do what they wanted. And for the Jew, this would be an extremely alarming place to go, but Jesus is leading his disciples there. And as he's going, he says, guys, who do people say that I am? In this pantheon of gods that are worshiped in this community, where do I rank? How do people see me? And so the disciples, always hoping to offer an answer that they know, they say, John the Baptist, Elijah, the prophets. Jesus makes no comments to that. But he turns instead to ask the most poignant question that each of us will ever face in our entire lives. He looks at his disciples and say, that's all fine and good, but who do you say that I am? And my claim here today is that this is the question each of us must face at some point in our lives, probably multiple points in our lives, to really begin a journey of faith. And that if we can't answer this clearly, if we don't have an understanding of what our response to Jesus' question is, the rest of the journey will also be as unclear. Don't be fooled. This question is at the heart of your understanding of who Jesus is. Who do you say that I am? I don't care about the world's comments. I want to know you, and I want to know who you are and who you say I am. Well, Peter steps in as a star pupil and says, you are the Messiah. And what's really fascinating, in Matthew's gospel, Jesus goes on to commend Peter. He says, Peter, blessed are you, for flesh and blood didn't give you this insight. It only comes from God himself. And as a matter of fact, this statement is going to be the bedrock, the foundation upon which I build my church. And Peter at this moment is probably feeling pretty good about himself. I got it. I aced the test. I know who I am. I'm in touch with the Spirit. And then Jesus says, this is what it looks like for me to be the Messiah. I'm going to suffer at the hands of religious leaders and the Pharisees. I'm going to be killed by them. And 3 days later, I'm going to rise again. My path, he says, as Messiah, is suffering, rejection, and death. Now, you've got to help the disciples out because this is the first time they're hearing this message and they don't take it well. As a matter of fact, Peter, again, as the representative of the disciples, feels like it's his responsibility to set Jesus straight. So he, like Jesus did with the blind man, I envision him taking Jesus by the hand off to the side and giving him a little pep talk. Jesus, I know you're having a bit of an off day. Let's get you back on track. We've been, you know, really the opinion polls are doing well. I really feel like you're surging. I think we can ride this thing out. Jesus, remember, you're here to save the day. You're here to defeat Rome. You're here to take down our greatest enemies. What's this talk about suffering and death, Jesus. See, it's reminiscent of that scene in The Princess Bride where Peter Falk, as the grandfather, is reading the story to his son, grandson. And as he gets to this end of the story, he tells them something, spoiler alert, I'm sorry, I'm gonna ruin this for you. If you have not seen the movie yet though, you should really reflect on some of your life choices. Because he tells them, and Wesley dies, and Fred Savage, the grandson, says, wait a second, Grandpa, stop. What do you mean he dies? What about Prince Humperdinck? Who gets him? He says, what do you mean? Well, who kills Prince Humperdinck? He says, nobody kills Prince Humperdinck. He lives. He goes, Dad, Grandpa, what's this story you're telling me? And he says, it looks like you're getting a little overworked. I'm gonna go ahead and shut the book. I don't think you wanna hear the rest of the story. And he has a decision at that point. Which version of this is he going to live out? Is he gonna live the version of the story where he has it already written in his head, or is he gonna let his grandpa finish it? Is he gonna let his grandpa tell him the story that's actually written and not the one that he wants or the one that he thinks will ultimately be the one that fits his narrative most fluidly? Because at this point, Jesus looks at his disciples and he realizes what Peter has just said is reflected in their eyes as well. And he sets his face in this moment and very directly looks at Peter and says probably one of the most difficult words he has to utter to his disciples in the course of their ministry. He says, get behind me, Satan. The one who had just delivered probably one of the most glowing responses to the identity of Jesus is now being aligned with Jesus' greatest enemy. Because I envision that the words that Jesus is hearing come out of Peter's mouth would be quite familiar to him. Actually, words he would have heard his greatest enemy, Satan, say at the beginning of his ministry when Jesus was taken up to a mountaintop. And Satan said to him, I'll give it to you all. You can have all the nations, all the peoples. All you have to do is bow down and worship me. It can be yours, Jesus, at a small price. Don't worry about going to the cross. Don't worry about suffering. Don't worry about death. I'll give it to you. And every effort to defer the suffering, to defer the call on his life was an obstacle that was straight from the pits of hell. And Jesus needed to let Peter know that he was not aligning himself with God's purposes and priorities, but Satan's. See, Peter didn't have a version of Jesus that included suffering. Not at the hands of religious leaders, definitely not at the hands of Rome. Jesus wasn't supposed to be one of Rome's conquering heroes, just the greatest version of them that would overthrow them and put the Jewish nation state back on the top of the world. He had no category for the Messiah who was gonna come and give his life. This doesn't fit who I've built this Messiah up to be. I thought I saw you clearly. But if they had been paying attention to the scriptures at all, Isaiah 53 is very clear what the Messiah was gonna come to do, but they had no category for a God who would come and suffer, who would bear their stripes, who would take their punishment. And so in many respects, Peter reflects this broken image that Satan so longs for us to create, of a false God that we then worship. See, Jesus joins in with this work to keep Jesus from his path, and Jesus will have none of it. He says to Peter, get behind me. I'm the rabbi, your disciple. I think you might have forgotten it for a moment, Peter, but let's get it straight. Who's in charge? Park your life behind me, because this is where I'm going. If you want to follow me, this is what it looks like. And so in this third vignette, Jesus gathers them all together and has this fascinating conversation. Because right before this, he had said to them, Peter, the reason you are doing this because you're not setting your mind on God's interests, but on man's interests. Your mind, the battleground for your allegiance, is being influenced by by those things which are not ultimately honoring to me or aligned with my purposes. I had the privilege this last fall to join the young adults of our church at the Walk Retreat. And I was sharing with them a decision I had to make this last summer, where in the course of some time, I just was realizing that maybe I'd spending a little bit too much time on my phone. I was finding myself on Facebook or Instagram, and I don't know if you've ever had this experience, but it feels a little bit like time has a time warp when you're on there, and like minutes become hours, and reel after reel, those algorithms are so specifically oriented that how do they know I wanted to see this next, and then this next, and then this next, and before I knew it, my mind and my heart were being shifted away from what God's heart was. And so I told them, I made the decision to delete those apps off my phone. And there was this collective gasp. Because I remember as I was thinking about it and I was going through my head, I was like, I might as well find a cave, crawl in a hole, and be lost to humanity because I won't know anything that's going on in the world. I might as well be, you know, removed from humanity and society. And those fears really started to take shape. And yet, by the grace of God, I had the courage to do that. And I remember, I'm standing here, hopefully aligned with most of what's going on still in the world, not having access to those for the last 4 months. But what I will tell you what's changed is my perspective, my attitude, my time has been far more available in that decision to set that aside and to let my mind be focused elsewhere. What does it mean to have our minds aligned? Do we understand all the influences that are vying for our attention and our allegiance? Do we realize how much we're giving away without even understanding we're doing it? And Jesus tells us, don't forget your mind. Where you think and how you think and what you think is incredibly important to me. Will you steward that well? Peter, you're not right now because you've allowed man's interests, your own. And if it happened to Peter and his disciples, it's gonna happen to us. We face the same temptations. We build a Jesus who we believe his responsibility is to make our lives work, to make our lives comfortable, to provide the resources in this community to keep life going smoothly, to support our causes, and to make sure that we come out on top. That's the Jesus many of us have built in our minds and our hearts. And like the Old Testament prophets had to do with those idols, that image has to be shattered. Jesus then, in this third vignette, gathers his disciples together and all the other people who are following him and says, if you want to know the real Jesus, if you want to see the real picture of who I am, if you want to come after me, there's three things I'm calling you to. First, deny yourself. Second, take up your cross. Third, now come follow me. And you've got to imagine these disciples who are listening to this, their circuits are blowing as Jesus himself begins to unpack what it means to be his disciple, to deny yourself, to renounce this false God you've built, to lay it down. And in many ways, what's so profoundly important about this is his heart behind it. Because two of my favorite psalms is 115 and 135. And in both of those psalms, the psalmist talks about the pagan gods and how idols are built. And he goes in each of these settings to say, these idols have ears, but they don't hear. They have mouths, but they don't speak. They have eyes, but they don't see. And then there's this chilling line in both of the psalms that follows this description of the idols. It says, those who make them will become like them. In essence, we become like that which we worship. And Jesus is inviting us to lay aside these idols. And I had this incredible privilege of going on this run with my boys yesterday. And we were processing this text. And I was thinking, guys, idols in the olden days just were so much more obvious. They built these things, they put them up on their mantelpieces, and they bowed down and worshiped them. Like, what are our idols today? I mean, you could say, well, we have our flat screen TVs above our mantelpiece, so maybe those from it. And my son kind of very astutely said, I think for many of us, it's our phones. And call me old, but I remember when a phone was used just to call people. But now they encompass so much more. And I don't know if you've ever been in a public setting like an airport or on a bus or even outside, you'll notice that people have this pleasant glow about their faces as they're buried in this device. And it almost seems like an entire world is captured in this little space of plastic and glass as we worship at our altars of these gods of our phones. And if we really do become like the things we worship, I was wondering if how that analogy extends. Do we have too many apps open? Does our battery life run low quickly? Are we sensitive to touch? I don't know. Maybe I'm getting too far about beyond myself, but the reality is, are we aware of the things that we're giving our worship to? And Jesus says, I want you to worship me. I want you to deny these gods, these false images of that you've built up in your life. I want you not simply to die, but I want you to deny them. I want you to die to them. And he uses fascinating imagery. He says, take up your cross, which for this Jewish community would be absolutely appalling to talk about the Roman form of execution. Take up your cross. Remember, Peter said, you're here to take out the Romans and you're telling us to take up their most vile form of embarrassment and humiliation in the destroying of human life, to take up our cross and follow you. Why? Why, Jesus? Because at the heart of this, they missed the last part of his statement. Yes, I'm coming to die. But after a short while, I'm going to be raised up again. I want you to know resurrection life. And as long as you cling to those idols you've made, you will never be able to have me fill your hands with the life that I long to give you, with the powerful reality of what my spirit actually brings to bear out in your life. And I have to be honest with you, as I was thinking about this passage, I was having trouble sleeping this last night, and I thought it was because of nerves and anxiety about getting up and standing in front of a bunch of people, and that was part of it. But as I got up out of bed and I spent some time talking to the Lord and saying, God, just help me deal with this. He had a different curriculum for me at about 11:30 this last night. He said, Brent, if you're gonna get up in front of people and talk about denying and dying, are you willing to do it? I said, yeah, oh, totally. He's like, really? He said, what about your anger? What about the anger that you use that you feel empowers you so much that gives you a justification for the way that you treat people and especially those closest to you? What about that? Are you willing to die to that? Okay, now we're treading, Lord. I feel like I'm justified in this, Lord. So can't we get, Brent, are you willing to die? And so I had to sort of say, yes, Lord, if this means following you, I will. And so I woke up my sweet sleeping wife, which is not always the best idea. But I think it was helpful because she wasn't as coherent about what I was saying. So maybe that helped a little bit. And I said, hon, I need you to know, I'm sorry. I've let my anger and my anger toward you cause a distance there that has helped me feel just in how I'm thinking, but not has engaged your heart or let you feel safe in the space. And I just want you to know, I don't want that. I don't want to use that power because it's not real. It's actually killing me in the process. She graciously either just wanted to get back to sleep or whatever it was, forgave me. And it was fascinating because I was able right after that to get back to sleep. It was as if the Lord was saying, Brent, you think it's one thing, but actually what I'm calling you to, if you're going to get up and talk about it, you have to deal with me as well. And so graciously, God gives us the call to deny, to die, that we might experience his life. And I want to introduce you to someone else who is doing this in a very profound and beautiful way in her own life. Ashlyn, would you go ahead and come on up? I had the privilege of meeting Tyler, Ashlyn's husband, at one of our lunches here at church. And he started telling me about his wife and the journey she's been on. And I wanted her to come and share her story with us. So Ashlyn, would you, welcome by the way, would you tell us a little bit about your story?
Yes. Good morning, Crossroads. I'm honored to share a bit of my story with you today. As a child, I felt close to God. I grew up with loving parents who taught me how to pray. I went to church, youth group, and read the Bible, but I also carried an inner restlessness that I couldn't explain. As a teen, I struggled with bulimia, and in my 20s, that shifted to alcohol. Both shared the same grip on my life of secrecy, hiding, and escaping reality. As hard as I tried to be a normal drinker, once I started, I couldn't stop. That led to unhealthy relationships, totaled cars, and legal trouble. Many mornings, I woke up with gripping anxiety, trying to piece together what had happened the night before. Over time, my drinking became more isolated and more frequent because I wanted to drink how I wanted without hearing about it from anyone else. I did all of this while appearing successful from a distance. I earned my master's degree and became a school counselor. But the reality was that I'd black out alone at night, then show up to teach coping skills to kids the next morning. It was easy for me to rationalize my problems away because I didn't fall into the stereotype of what I thought living in addiction looked like. But the mental grip it had over me was exhausting. I was so tired of myself, but I couldn't stop the cycle. One of my last nights drinking, I was walking in the middle of the cold winter to buy more alcohol. I looked up at the stars, and I prayed for the first time in a long time and asked God to make it stop. I didn't care how, I just wanted the chaos in my mind and my life to stop. Something in me shifted, and the next day I attended an AA meeting. The following night, I felt God calling me to my grandpa's assisted living center. He was a lifelong alcoholic and his health had been declining rapidly. I felt like he was the only one who could understand me. I prayed with him while I held his hand and then I returned home. He passed away that night, and from then on, I committed to sobriety. I haven't had a drink in over 8 years. Woo! For me, finding community and realizing I wasn't alone changed everything. One of the steps in AA is turning your life and your will over to God. For many people, that's difficult, but because of my roots, I knew exactly who God was. I started reading the Bible again, going to church, and I felt excited that I could finally live my life closer to His design. God protected me in many situations during my drinking, and He pursued me in my darkest moments. Today, I have a wonderful husband, meaningful relationships, and a church family. The life I have now is far bigger and sweeter than I could have imagined because of God.
Thanks, Ashley. That's awesome. Ashton, how would you say God has taken your story and used it in ways you never thought possible?
So when I first stopped drinking, I suddenly had a lot of free time on my hands. I started taking bar fitness classes. That's spelled B-A-R-R-E, not B-A-R, which I've had to clarify a few times. I became certified to teach, and my counseling background combined with my own recovery and love of fitness inspired the Recovery Bar, which blends a sobriety meeting with a free bar and Pilates class. During COVID, I hosted it virtually, and the response was overwhelming and clearly bigger than what I could do alone. So on November 6th of this year, my 8th sober anniversary, I officially launched the Recovery Bar as a nonprofit and instructor training so more people in sobriety can have access to movement and community. God opened the door to partner with a major group fitness company, allowing it to reach far more people than I could on my own. Our first training in 2026 has participants across 10 states registered with plans to support their own communities. To me, these moments provide confirmation, and I'm continually in awe of how God moves when He plans to use something for His will.
In what ways are you seeing God show you more of who He is and giving you an opportunity to bring His kingdom to those around you?
So on Tuesdays, I lead the Recovery Bar at the Alano North Club of Kent County, and I've watched God use it to help people find community, feel less isolated, and care for their minds and bodies. Recently, someone messaged me saying that she wanted to come, but she was nervous. I encouraged her to join, and when she arrived, I welcomed her with a big hug and tried to help her feel as comfortable as possible. She came back the next week and shared that she had exactly 1 week sober, the most she'd been able to string together in years. Another participant shared that she wouldn't have stayed sober over the past few weeks without coming to class. She had tried to stop drinking on her own many times, but being around people who could relate made it feel possible. Many participants have shared that they are unsure about faith, and every week I see God creating opportunities to walk alongside them and shine his light in both big and subtle ways. I'm honored to build relationships with people from so many different backgrounds, especially because I know from experience that getting sober is the first step toward living the life God calls us to. Personally, I feel God breaking down shame and the lie that I'm different or I don't belong. He's used the people here at church and in our house church to remind me that his character is welcoming, and he calls us to live in community as the body of Christ. Living in community is the opposite of living in secrecy and hiding. You become known. Because the recovery bar is connected to my story, there are many moments where it feels uncomfortable to have out there. In those moments, I cling to the truth that my identity is in Jesus, and that surrendering to him means dying to myself, picking up my cross, and going, even when I feel afraid. By laying down my life to follow him, he can work through me to make his goodness and redemption visible to others. I find comfort in knowing that I'm simply a vessel for all that he's doing.
Amen. Thank you, Ashlyn. You got it. Thank you for your courage to share that. I remember talking to Tyler, and he had been mentioning that Ashlyn was doing this, and then said, but she feels like she's not involved in ministry. And I was like, are you kidding me? There's a group of individuals who declare themselves atheists who follow her around to her different classes. We'll only take the classes that she teaches because they see something in her, a light and a life that has been born out of her brokenness. That as she has denied herself and died, she's found the resurrection life of Jesus, and it is attractive, and people long to be a part of it. Because in God's economy, it is backwards from the way the world operates. Because Jesus gathering his disciples together, he says, what I care about is your soul. In our economy, those who hold on to their lives, they lose it. But those who give up their lives for me and my gospel's sake, they will find it. And in so doing, they will live out my purpose for them. I was actually just talking to a gentleman at the end of the first service who recently retired. He says, I've got time on my hands, Brent. What do I do? And I just loved it because he was basically saying, at this juncture in my life, when most people would say, it's time to go golf and live on a beach, I want to be used by the master. I want my life to matter for something. I want to give it away and watch what he brings as a result. Because in the kingdom value, the soul is of utmost importance. God cares so deeply about our souls, so much so that he says, if we were to take a scale and you were to put everything the world offers on one side, it still wouldn't balance out the weight of the human soul. It would not by any means come close to comparing. And as Jesus talks about this, the words from Psalm 49, verses 7-8 would ring in their minds. It says this, why should I fear in days of adversity, the psalmist says, when the iniquity of my foes surrounds me, even those who trust in their wealth and boast in the abundance of their riches, no man can by any means redeem his brother or give to God a ransom for him. For the redemption of his soul is costly. And he should cease trying forever, that he should live on eternally, that he should not undergo decay. What is our soul? Jesus tells us here that this soul is of inestimable value, that nothing in this world can compare to it. And if we were to give it all, it still wouldn't come close to the cost and value of our souls. And the Hebrew mind was called nephesh, and it incorporated the body, the mind, the spirit. It was all one, but it was that which was breathed into us by the living God, which made us living beings, and is that which in us that is the truest parts of who we are. It is our essence and the eternal nature of who God made us to be. But in our mindset, we've taken the soul and we've partitioned it away from our body and our mind, and we cultivate the body and we cultivate the mind, oftentimes leaving the soul to receive the crumbs that are left over. But Jesus says we have it backwards. The soul is what values, is what is valued by God, and what we are to value as a result. And when we fix our eyes on eternity and we follow our Savior, we find the value that he has put there because he loves our soul. He is the one who has redeemed our soul, the one who denied himself the pleasures of heaven, who came to walk amongst us, to take up his cross and ultimately give himself in redemption of our soul. Jesus says at the end of this passage, there will be a time of reckoning when my words will bear out versus the world's offer. Which one will you take? If you choose to let this world and its values dictate you, then you have basically said that you're ashamed of my words. And I don't want that to be the outcome for you, but right now you can't see me clearly because you've created me in your image. That image has to die so that the real one can be born and I can fill you with the life that I long to give you. Because Voltaire saw our tendency to remake God in our own image, to meet our needs. Peter did this, the disciples did this, we do this. And he has come to say, here's the threshold. Are you willing to follow me? Are you willing to step over that belief that you have created in your mind, where I'm here to make your life work or make it better, and come to see that I've not come to make your life better. I've come to give you life, to transform it. So it's not even just about you anymore, but it's about this world that I care so desperately for, that I long for. It's a season right now where we are going to think about New Year's resolutions. And oftentimes our list looks like this. I'm committing to losing weight. Getting back into the gym, I'm gonna drink more water and less alcohol, I'm gonna stop smoking. It usually involves adding more to our plate of things that we can do. And oftentimes the joke is, how long do those resolutions last? Not typically beyond the paper it takes to write them. But instead of the self-care that we so often focus on, what if this new year was about soul care? What if we actually started to take more seriously what it would be to value the souls that God has given us, to place our priority where Jesus himself has placed it? In the course of this run, my son was bemoaning the fact that I just feel like I've got to add more and more to my plate. And my other son said, what if it was about taking some things away, creating some space so that we could actually hear from God and say, invite him into that process. Say, Lord, what is it? What is keeping me from you? What is getting in the way from me laying down my life and living in the resurrection hope that you've called me to? What have I substituted from the real Jesus in my own version of things? And will you be willing to graciously deal with me and help me to experience the life that you really have for me? I'm gonna challenge you that you find 5, 10, 15 minutes before this year is out and just spend some time with Jesus. Jesus, would you just help me navigate what this next year could look like so that it's not simply just another exercise at failed promises and unresolved resolutions, but that instead God would be stirring something in your heart. Because it is a gift to have these seasons where we reflect on where we've come from and look forward to where we're going. My prayer is that it would not simply be about adding things that we feel are fixing up that which is not ultimately eternal, but spending times on those things that ultimately value what God has valued. And my prayer is that we look back on this next year, we will have seen what God has done as he's cultivated that in our lives. Let's